Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00029. Recorded on March 17, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
I cannot be absolutely certain in this notion. It seems to me that something has changed in the basic landscape in DFW in the past year or two. We are in the transitional season from winter to summer here. And what we can expect to have with that year after year, apart from all the thunderstorms and tornadoes and hail and all that shit that happens in the sky, our ground, our landscape will do and be certain things and ways. And typically what we have is, you know, the dormant grass of the winter season starting to spring up. A weed here, a weed there, right? Well, groups and patches of weeds here and there before the grass starts to green up and start growing and choke them out, right? You can expect that. What's happening now that I don't expect is like a massively increased number in the variety of different weeds that are all springing up at the same fucking time here, you know? In my memory, it's like the weeds that we have here locally in our region, they kind of have their time and their place, and then they give way to some other weed that comes along, right? That's what plants generally do. But here and now, we've got the dormant grass. Everything is kind of like that dismal gray-brown, and then all these weeds of all these varieties are shooting up all over the fucking place. And there's lots of them. And like, what do you do with them? You mow them, they'll just grow right back. Right? We're in a season where it's generally still a little rainy here and there. All you need is rain and sun. Those things just shoot right up. So if you just mow over them, that's good for a day or two. Then they just shoot right back up. You can't go around and pull them out of the fucking ground. You'll break your back all day long. And then, you know, you pull one out here and three of them grow over there. So it's just like this ugly little time. You got to wait for the grass to grow up and start choking this shit out and then mow everything down even, right? But until then, we are in the ugly scape. That's what I call it, the ugly scape. I look out my back window through the kitchen window in the backyard in the morning, the sun coming down, and I look at the lawn. My lawn is more than dormant. It's dead, but it looks like everybody else's right now. I just know it ain't going to come up green. At least I think it ain't going to come up green. But everything else that's going on, it's just, you got that ugly, pale gray, brown color of dormant lawn. And then all these weeds just shooting out all over the fucking place. I got them. The neighbors got, everybody's got them. It's just ugly everywhere, right? It's the ugly scape. And it just seems uglier than usual because there's so many different kind of weeds. And some of these weeds are really fucking ugly. Now, what I've noticed, besides just really ugly weeds, is that there's a larger variety of, like, ground cover types. Weeds that kind of grow low to the ground and spread. You know, we got three of them right here on the property at work, just in a section all by itself. And I never knew the names of these. I had to go find them. I had to go look them up and shit. Dead nettle is one of them. One called Creeping Charlie. Creeping Charlie. Now, the dead nettle is all over my backyard. And they shoot up like these purple flowers, which you would think, all right, so you got some kind of ground cover with purple flowers. That's cool. No, the flowers are fucking ugly. The leaves are ugly. They look like all dusted and shit. They're fucked up. They're weird. And it's not quite exactly ground cover. They're getting tall, right? So they're all over my backyard, and there's some out here on this property here on the job. The Creeping Charlie, like I mentioned, and then this chickweed, right? Chickweed is kind of the normal one. That's the one that you expect to see around. They make the little white flowers, I think. I think those are kind of typical. That's what I remember during this ugly scape season of the year. And the chickweed is the one that my spiny lizard, right? The Texas spiny lizard that I've given temporary residence to in my home to try to save its life and keep it going. It was tangled up in that shit, right? That's a ground cover type of weed, and it got its back foot caught up in that, and it couldn't get out. So yeah, it was that chickweed that did that. What's really fucked up is this one plant. I don't remember ever seeing it before. If I did, it would be something like I would see like out in a field. You go out to one of the farm-to-market roads like out East Texas somewhere, and you got this rotten fence post with rusted barbed wire hanging off of it, and then there's fucking weed growing out of the ground next to it. That's where this thing belongs. It doesn't belong here in suburbia for sure. It's called spiny. Here's another spiny thing. You get the spiny lizard, and you get this spiny sow thistle, right? Everything's spiny here in Texas. The spiny sow thistle. Look it up. Look at a picture. I don't think I could give you the words to really describe it and how hideous it gets to being. And I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 within like a square yard, right? Just out the window here. These are little baby ones. They're like 18 inches tall. Right? 18 inches tall for a weed. That's a little baby one. We had a couple of them in our backyard that were over hip high. And they were starting to, like, the trunks on them, you know. The stems were becoming trunks. They were like saplings. These things, they're like crabgrass at the bottom. And then they grow like a stalk that goes up that becomes like a fucking trunk and branches out. And when it branches out, it has a couple little ugly leaves on them to match the ugly crabgrass shit at the bottom. And they flower like these little miniature dandelions. The bigger they get, the uglier they get. Yeah, it's crabgrass ugly. When I'm talking ugly, it's like that ugliness of crabgrass. You think of crabgrass and, you know, regard it as that type of ugly. I'm trying to describe this shit to you. I don't remember seeing these things, and they're just fucking everywhere. And they're a monstrosity. They grow so fucking tall, so quick. And I'm about going to start cutting down some of these fucking things in the next couple of days. Here we go, right? And of course, we got the dandelions, right? Your normal old American dandelion, they're everywhere. We also got Texas dandelions, right? They're different. They're dandelion, but they're a little different. They, from the, like the green part, from the ground up to the flower, they're about dandelion like you'd expect a dandelion to be. But then the flower itself, a little different. The petals, a little different in shape, and the colors of them, the yellow, it ain't like dandelion yellow. It's like highlight marker yellow. It's got that fluorescence about it. They're really cool. I think they're really cool. A weed nonetheless. Also saw my first evening primrose of the year yesterday, right? Yesterday. I was doing around. There it was in the ground. And they're nothing spectacular, but they are technically actual wildflowers. And wildflowers are a thing here in Texas on the prairie. You're living in a space, you know, geological region that is, by and large, featureless. And wildflowers on the ground, in patches, they start to become features for you in a featureless landscape, right? And that's why they're cool. And I guess, well, you know, if you're not a Texan, you're not from DFW area, never lived here, don't know nothing about it, if you got here, you would actually adopt that perspective in time. Wildflowers start to become a really cool thing when you are acclimated to a featureless landscape, right? So the first evening primrose. Primrose is typically the first wildflower that comes up, in my reckoning anyway, right? But the springtime is wildflower season in Texas. It's a big fucking deal, really, in a lot of ways. You know, the biggest wildflower in Texas is the bluebonnet, right? It's the state flower. They grow, I don't know, how tall do they get? 12 to 18 inches maybe in height, and they get, you know, a straight stem shoots up, and then you get these little but very bright blue flowers that grow around them, kind of like in the shape of a pine cone, sort of like that. Not a great description. But then you get patches of them all together, and that blueness creates like a glowing hue in the area, and it's really cool. Sometimes you'll be just driving down a highway, there'll be a hillside that's just covered with them, right? They've got places out in a couple counties south of here, like heading down towards Waco, that area where they've got some hills, right? Hillsboro, Texas. You got some hills and you got some open land, and they'll have like country lanes that are running through, and you'll just have all these regions that are covered with bluebonnets, and people go out there. It's like, you know, you're in DFW and you're going into somebody's house for the first time, and you go by their staircase, and on the wall over there, they got the family pictures, and invariably, you're going to have the family picture where the mother and the father were laying in a patch of bluebonnets when they were dating, and then a newer picture with the kids all in the bluebonnets when they were growing up. It's a part of Texas culture here, some identity with the bluebonnets, and they are really fascinating. They're not the only wildflower around. And they come and go pretty quick. You know, you got like a 2, 3, 4 weeks, not two, maybe about a month. Usually, what, April into May, you know, somewhere in there they come and go, if I remember right. We're still at the end of March right now. We got the evening primrose going. We'll also have Indian paintbrush and the Mexican hats. I like the Mexican hats. I like them all. But this is, you know, we see this shit all over the place in the springtime, in the wild areas generally, right? Obviously in the suburbs, people mow everything down, fuck everything up. But get out into the open country a little bit and you'll see patches of this stuff. It's kind of cool. So we got our first evening primrose here at on the work property. And it's like the lone thing of beauty, like in the ugly scape, all these fucking weeds growing on dormant grass, and you got the one wildflower in the middle of it. The lone thing of beauty. Now, speaking of weeds, right? Speaking of, we're going to move off in a completely different direction now. But since I was speaking of weeds, something that is definitely associated with weed or weeds is the potheads, right? Burnouts, marijuana smokers, right? Which I was one. And it turns out, because I've been giving this some thought, it occurred to me, and I don't know how it happened, but just the shit that runs through my mind. And some of it runs through my mind and out of my mouth, and some of it kind of gets stuck up there and has to be pondered for a while. This was one of those pondering situations, right? I had this thought come to my mind that I've really never ceased to be a burnout, in spite of the fact that I haven't had any drugs or alcohol for 34 plus years, right? That's a long fucking time. And no matter what I've experienced in my life, and in spite of the fact that I've experienced it clean and sober, I yet somehow either retain or I am chained to, stuck to, the fact of my burnoutedness from my teenage years, right? I was a high school burnout. And I seem to have thrown that off of my back and moved on. But every time I get the idea that I've done something like that, there's something comes along that shows me plainly, nah, all you are is a burnout who ain't doing drugs. And since you ain't done drugs, you're kind of almost like a normal member of society. Like, you can get a job, you can hold a job, and you could start to do things that normal people do, but you're still burnout. That's not going to change. It's not a matter how I look, how I dress. It's just there's something integral in my composition. You know, whatever broke in me, that led to me finding myself as a burnout never really got repaired, I guess. I don't know. I'm going to be doing a lot of soul searching in these regards, and I think we're going to talk about this kind of stuff. But yeah, the idea came in my mind, and I kind of look at it now. Once a burnout, always a burnout, right? Once a burnout, always a burnout. It is a seemingly permanent disposition that I have. What I mean to say by that is, you know, we all have our worldview, and there's a whole variety of worldviews that people have. And people can change from one worldview to another. And no matter what your worldview is, you still yet have a perspective where you come from, right? My perspective is a perspective of a burnout in high school. My worldview are like sunglasses, lenses that I put over my face that my eyes peer through, right? So the lenses represent the worldview that I have. But my eyes are still that of a high school burnout. Make sense? Perspection going through a worldview. A perspective going through a worldview. My perspective, for whatever reason, will always be that of a burnout. Maybe because it's just, you know, being a burnout, being a teenager, that was a time of transition. I keep talking about this transition of seasons and shit. That was a time of transition in life in general. A very rough one for just about all of us. And probably most everything that we encountered during those times was never really fully settled. That's a feeling I get. I don't know if people my age, anybody, adults who've gone through it, whatever your age may be, you walk away with this sense going forward of everything being unsettled. Never really having the questions of your existence being answered through those times, right? I may be just fucked up, you know? I don't know. But to me, that's what it's like. It's like, I've never really solved my childhood. I've never really made sense of it. I just had to accept the fact or whatever the facts were, kind of close a book on it, put my head down and move on, right? And every once in a while, I open up the book, and the book is called You're a Fucking Burnout Still, No Matter What You Think, Part 1, you know? Even without the drugs and everything. Now, what do I mean by burnout, right? I keep using that, but I'm throwing it around, and you're out there in the future, 100 years from now, and you're like, what the fuck is this guy talking about, burnout? Burnout. I made a little reference to it earlier, right? Introducing the subject, the association with weed, a pot smoker, right? A burnout was a subset of the student body in my high school years, which were the early 80s, and we were basically known for doing drugs to the point of burning our brains out, right? That's one way of looking at it, or adopting a lifestyle so fast-paced that you were bound to die young is another way to look at it. But the two go hand in hand. They're not mutually exclusive. They're both generally true for everybody who are burnouts going through that part of their life, right? So the burnouts, and you know, you can get really particular about exactly what a burnout was, but ultimately it was a matter of the subset of kids in your school that were on drugs, seriously on drugs, not just kind of dabbling, like smoke a bone, like once your senior year and go off to college. No. It was the core of the life. It was the center. It was the center of our universe. That's what our lives evolved around. It was getting drugs, doing drugs. Now, we were burnouts. And there were plenty of us, too. There were plenty of us. In fact, there were so many of us that you could really break it down into subsets, right? Burnout in general. Like, you had an umbrella burnout. And then under the umbrella, you had, like, punk rockers, for example. You had hippies, like the Deadheads and shit, right? For another example. And you had, like, the heavy metal headbanger types. And you had the... I mean, my crew, more or less, like the biker types. We were biker types. We were too young to be riding street bikes generally, and we weren't in any kind of gang per se. But we lived like bikers, and we dressed like bikers, and you know, we grew our hair and grew our beards like bikers. And like, I was kind of more like that than any of these other subgroups, but I never had any aspirations of actually getting a Harley. I have one now, but then, no. Or being a biker, but we lived like bikers, you know? We even wore like biker leather jackets. It was a distinction. It was a distinction that we had. So you had that kind of group of us. You had like motorheads, right? The motorheads were the ones that were very mechanical. They were always under the hood of a car, always adding more muscle to their muscle cars, but they like to smoke pot, they like to drink beer, listen to Led Zeppelin, you know. So you had all these kind of subtypes of burnouts as it was at that time. I'm sure it's multiplied exponentially by now. That was your freaks, right? The high school freaks were the burnouts. In fact, in the 70s, they called themselves freaks. In the 80s, we were burnouts, but we were the freaks at a school, right? And so the freakiness gets just freakier over generations. You've seen that. And the way things are right now is just, it's incredible. It's incredible. Not in a good way, but it's incredible nonetheless. So that's, that's hopefully draws kind of a picture of what a burnout is in my mind, what it was in the 80s, the subgroups that make it up. And see, but you didn't have like a distinction. You didn't have just like, oh, there's a punk rock party, you can't go there. No, it's people who were on drugs all did everything together. And some of them were kind of just more oriented towards punk rock. Some of them were oriented towards Jerry Garcia, you know, shit like that. But we all were always together doing our thing, which was anything centered around drugs. Drugs and anything centered around drugs. Seriously, you didn't do shit without drugs involved. It was always about getting fucked up and being together and doing fucked up things in a fucked up manner from a fucked up point of view. So yeah, there's your 80s burnout. But see, when you had it's easy for me to look at what we had as burnouts in the early 80s and categorize them into like subgroups. But then you realize, like at a house party, all those subgroups were there. And then you had people that were kind of in the middle of it all. That's what I say. Like me, I kind of leaned towards like that biker type. But it was a leaning. I was really all of the above. Except for the Motorhead. I didn't have mechanical skills. And I didn't really have much of a desire at that time about cars and shit. Right? But I was an amalgamation of pretty much all the rest. I wasn't really pinned down to any particular group like that, you know. I could call myself just a plain burnout because of that. But see, when you have that amalgamation, when you pull all that stuff together, what you end up having is what I call grunge before there was grunge, right? We were grunge before there was grunge. Grunge came 10 years later, right? And it was literally an amalgamation of all of the freakiness, all of the subgroups and subcultures of freakiness before it. It all kind of came together in one place at one time and became its own one thing for a moment, you know, and then spread out again. It was sort of like a sand through the hourglass sort of thing. But yeah, we were absolutely grunge before there was grunge. Grunge wasn't really much different than what we were doing, you know. But it became fashionable. It spawned a genre of music, which really, if you look at the genre of music, there was hardly anything absolutely unique and original that was coming out of grunge itself. Grunge was more of a time, an era that had music, that had fashion, right? Had something to say. But as far as how you define grunge music, it was an amalgamation of everything that came before it, right? That's all it was. It was just kind of everything that there was already kind of just slapped together. And there were different concoctions of each, you know? Some of the grunge bands, for example, were a little bit punkier than others. Some of them are a lot more heavy metal than others. Some of them were like more classic rock than others. A great example, literally a great example. And we'll talk about Kurt Cobain a little bit, right? In a little bit. But an example of this amalgamation I'm talking about, I could think of Nirvana. I look at Nirvana as some kind of a weird combination of like punk rock, classic rock, and a heavy leaning towards the Beatles of all things, right? You know, I'm not a Beatles fan, but I know the Beatles. And what's powerful about the Beatles is their range of melody, right? It's just very melodic music that really encompasses a whole lot of different genres. It's not really straight rock and roll. It was early on for a little while, but when they got licensed to go their own way, it became all kinds of shit, all kinds of experimental stuff and things like that. And a lot of things that are just very English and not American, but they were very melodic, you know. And but my use of that word, I mean to say, is like they had great melodies, right? Great melodies, something that would grab you, catch you. And everything would be based on the lyric and the melody in the song. Everything was kind of suited around it, fit around it. Where something like punk rock, ordinarily, you would have a statement to make and you would have your lyrics, but you would jam them into this loud, abrasive is the word I'm looking for, right? This loud, abrasive music, which is the tone you're setting, and it's like you kind of just jam the words into it, right? You understand what I'm saying? It's like you set the music first to set who you are, and then you jam the words and your melody into that, and the words and the melody seem to get washed over. They just kind of seem to take like second place to it, from a perspective of a listener, right? Now, I'm sure the singer up there thought his words meant everything. It was fucking gospel to him, but and that's not the way I mean this to be. From the perspective of a listener, the words get lost because they get muddled and buried in everything else that's going on. Whereas somebody like the Beatles, who are very melodic, everything starts with the melody and accompanies it and actually pushes it forward. Now, Nirvana, like I brought up, they had a weird way of combining the two, right? And the way it was I call them like bombastic, right? Bombastic type of grunge music. And they were not the only ones that were bombastic. Let me explain bombastic to you, how I mean it in music. You'll have a nice, pretty, Beatlesque, say, verse, right, of a song. And it'll be melodic, and everything will be built around that melody, and the words are legible. And then all of a sudden, you break out of that into some kind of heavy thudding music, like punk, right? You go from this very quiet and subdued melodic to this very loud and bombastic, and then you settle back down into it, and loud and bombastic. That's how Nirvana really did it. You know, it's like Kurt Cobain kind of mumbled into a microphone, and everything was subdued and subdued and subdued, and that's when you kind of got hypnotized into something quiet and tranquil. And it would just go freak out again, and then it would settle back down, and it was kind of like a heart monitor, right? EKG reading, just up and down like that. The first time I noticed that in music, actually, had nothing to do with grunge. It was 10 years earlier. Pink Floyd, their worst fucking album, I don't like, The Final Cut, right? I got it hot off the presses when it came out. In fact, my little Tang girlfriend bought it for me. It was a really special gift and a big deal. But it was just all politics and bullshit, you know. But the music on that album was bombastic in the same regard. Quiet, melodic, and then all of a sudden it got really loud. It wasn't punk exactly, but it just got really fucking loud all of a sudden. And then it would just settle back down again. And I would hate that because, like, I'd be in my room in the middle of the night. I had my stereo on. I'm, like, smoking pot and trying to be quiet so not to wake anybody up because they'll smell the weed, you know. And I got Pink Floyd, you know, nice subtle Pink Floyd music in the background. And I had the volume all the way down to like 2 on the dial, but even at 2, these loud parts would come up, and it was like if I turned it all the way down to where the loud wasn't so loud, then the quiet was completely off the dial. You didn't hear, it was fucked up. But it made me aware of just like this use of volume and, you know, the way you can express and highlight melody, right? Like that. So that's what Nirvana achieved. And they were really a combination of just classic rock and punk. Well, I think with a real leaning towards the Beatles, whether it was intentional or not, I know they had an intent towards classic rock and punk alike. I know that Kurt Cobain admired all the punk rock. The local Seattle punk rockers of his time were the people he admired. But, you know, the greatest, their most popular song, the song that blew the doors off of, blew the doors open for the grunge scene in Seattle, on a popular international level, was Smell Like Teen Spirit, right? That song was a ripoff. The rhythm sections of it was a ripoff of More Than a Feeling from Boston. Kurt Cobain was trying to play the rhythm for it and couldn't quite get it down, and that ended up being the rhythm for the chorus of Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was a girl's deodorant, or yeah, girl's deodorant at the time. Teen Spirit. Anyhow, yeah, truly that, right? All I'm trying to say with all this stuff about grunge is really it was just taking everything about freakdom, about all the burnouts and all the different subcultures that were centered on the use of drugs, right, and self-destruction, basically, partying in general, however you want to look at it, and kind of bring it all into one place. And then it got put under the microscope of society for a brief period of time. And what did they see? Well, they'd see what you would see in a burnout. And I'm going to get into all this kind of stuff. This is going to get bad. It's going to get heavy, right? So grunge was the era of the early 90s, generally speaking. Specifically, it was like 91, 92, 93. Died in 94 and became post-grunge shortly thereafter, right? So, but you look at the early 90s as the grunge era. You look at the late 90s as the post-grunge era. And that's a way to fly, all right? That's a way to fly. If you base your culture, your pop culture, on rock and roll-oriented standards, you know, like I tend to do. You may come from a different culture that perceives culture through time in a completely different way. This was all like the hip-hop era, right? The hip-hop, you know, rap was going into gangster rap, and then the hip-hop, all at the same time, the grunge broke open. Then you had the post-grunge, and I don't know what happened with all the hip-hops and raps after that. They go on and on and on. They're a staple of our culture and entertainment, and have been for a very long time, but that's never really been my cup of tea. I can't speak very much to it. Anyway, so the grunge era, like I said, the early 90s, and you know, it would have been the perfect time for me because I was a burnout. I was a burnout to such an extent that, you know, years and years and years, 40 years later, I can't even shake that off of me, right? Once a burnout, always a burnout. So the greatest time for a burnout to be would have been the grunge years. Because that was like the heyday of burnoutness. That was like Revenge of the Burnouts right there. You know, you had Revenge of the Nerds, the movies in the 80s. Then you had the Revenge of the Burnouts in the grunge era. That's what that time was. And you know what? I missed the boat. I got sober in 88. I got sober before it happened. And I missed the boat. I did not get to engage on the party scene. And, of course, that was a society that was centered around drugs. My life at that point was centered around staying away from drugs, being sober, right? So I was like the antithesis of it all, but yet that was my place and time. And I, you know, I fucking... I missed my moment, really. I missed my moment. That would have been the time for me. I probably wouldn't have survived it, but, well, I survived everything else. Who could say? You know, it was weird. It's like when I got sober, it was the days of like, musically speaking, Guns N' Roses came out, you know, Welcome to the Jungle. It was that big thing, and it was a phenomenon. All it was kind of like a rougher, dirtier version of Van Halen, right, in terms of music. But the roughness and the dirtiness, like, put a fucking dagger through the heart of all that hairband stuff, right? The makeup went away and all the poofy fucking hair. You know, well, not all the fashion went away. A lot of it stayed. But it started to, like, dirty down and become more masculine again at that moment. So you're like 87, 88, 89, right? Before grunge broke open, you had this, it was really, that was hard rock is what it was. Guns N' Roses was hard rock, and hard rock was coming back into fashion again, and they lit the fire, right? That was coming out of like Los Angeles, I think, where all the hair bands, the big scene was. I stumbled onto that one day. That's not my cup of tea either, but one day it was like that. It was Guns N' Roses on your radio, and then like on TV it was Married with Children, right? Al Bundy and Peg Bundy. That was kind of like culture of burnouts. You had like your burnout music was on the lines of Guns N' Roses, and then you had your burnout like family. Your burnout TV family was the Bundys, right? Al Bundy's the loser, the fucking shoe salesman. In high school he was a football player. But the outcome is, you know, that him and his wife obviously were party people. And now they're raising kids who are obviously party people. But they don't, you know, they don't sit there and pull out bongs from behind the fucking couch and start smoking it up. It wasn't like that. Just, if you knew, you knew. You'd look at it. And it was very shocking at the time, you know. Their treatment of family life at the time was a shocking thing. It was a culture shock. And it was a big deal. But one day it was that. One day it was Guns N' Roses on the radio and Married with Children on TV. And then the next day it was Nirvana on the radio, and then Roseanne, which came out shortly after Married with Children. They became like, they were the same thing, but they were the grunge version of the Bundys, basically. And, you know, culture audibly and visually, for me, from where I was at in New Jersey back then, that's what it looked like. And I was sober. I was clean and sober when it happened, you know? Shit just fucking changed. It wasn't a big change. It was just a gradual thing. But all of a sudden, gone was the hair metal. I mean, it was fucking gone. It was killed. It was lit on fire and burnt like disco had been like 10 years earlier, right? It was all the rage one day, and then it was fucking completely obliterated. Then you had a couple of bands that kind of led up to it in the late 80s. You know, Metallica really carried the fucking torch through that hair band shit. The Metallica is worth noting. They really carried it. But I think Guns N' Roses filled the void of David Lee Roth leaving Van Halen. And that was just never right afterwards, as far as I was concerned. Van Halen was Van Halen, and David Lee Roth, not the greatest fan of his, but he was the entertainment factor that made that band that band. He really was. The attitude, that was rock and roll. That was 1970s and early 80s rock and roll, you know. And it wasn't the same without him. It wasn't the same. It was a different beast altogether. And I think when Guns N' Roses came in, they kind of like filled that void back up and gave it kind of a filthy edge, a dirty, a punk edge, but it wasn't punk music. At that same time, and I didn't catch it right away, it took me a couple of years, Jane's Addiction, right? Jane, also out of California, I think the LA area. They had music that really was, I think, the prequel to what grunge would be. They had all the elements of it in there. I mean, everything. Even additional freakism on top of it with the singer was just a nut. What, Perry Farrell? And before I really started paying any attention to grunge, really, very much, like spending my money on it, it was on the radios and everything like that. I was a Metallica head at that time. That was my thing. Yeah, and Motorhead, right? Motorhead, they were still cranking along. I was listening to Metallica and Motorhead. And then, you know, in the late 80s, that was my shit. Somewhere along the way, I have friends in AA. Friends in AA. One of them was just always up on the latest music and everything like that. And I was hanging out with him after a meeting. We went to a diner or something like that. And he had this music playing in the car, which turned out to be Jane's Addiction. Nothing shocking, right? Turned out to be that. And I was like, what is this shit? He told me. You know, he showed me the cover and everything like that. I was like, fucking cool. I thought it was great. I didn't know nothing about any of it, but I thought it was great. And it had probably already been out probably about 2 years by that time. And, hell, maybe three. I'm not even sure what year. I think it was like 89 it came. I don't know. But there was that going on. And I went out and bought the CD right away, and I took right to it. I liked it. Listened to it frequently. And, you know, Nine Inch Nails was already happening in the late 80s, but I didn't hear about that till a few years later. I just wasn't part of that scene at all. But I would be. I would be eventually. So they did got into all this pre-grunge stuff that led up to the Seattle bands breaking out into the mainstream like they did, and the grunge era, you know, setting the grunge era on fire as it was, right? There's all this extra stuff in here. But, like, in all that, what was going on, like, I use that expression, the revenge of the burnouts, right? What was going on in that was, like, a normalization of all these different aspects of freakism, right? Again, in the early 80s, when you were a burnout in your high school, you were part of the freaks. And I said, freaky, the freakiness of the freaks now is way beyond. Every generation just takes it another step further, right? I mean, we're getting into, like, transhumanistic shit at this point, you know, generations down the road where we are. It was a big deal when you had psychological issues to the extent where you had to put narcotics at the core of your existence, right? That was a freak once upon a time. Now a freak is that plus all this gender stuff and all this sexual preference stuff and God knows what else out there. I have no idea. I have no idea what's going on, right? What I'm trying to say, though, culturally speaking, pop culturally speaking, mass media speaking, in the culture, through the generations, right at the beginning of this grunge era, without regard to grunge music at all, right? Beginning of the 90s, end of the 80s, the normalization of this whole freakdom had occurred. It started anyway. Like I say, I mentioned TV shows like Married with Children. I mentioned TV show Roseanne, right? Roseanne, that came soon after. They were both late 80s and on through the 90s. Those were dysfunctional families that were functioning, right? And their functionability was in so much as just to keep them on TV week to week. And they were taking elements of abnormalcy and making them normal. This was not Leave It to Beaver anymore, right? I can't even begin to get into examples of shit. But what I'm trying to say is the normalization of everything that was freaky had begun at that point in time, right? And now the stage was set for the revenge of the burnouts. To come. So in my estimation, the quote-unquote normalization of freakdom had begun. This was the use of the mass media making the turn towards normalizing everything that was corrupt about our being, right? Now, I speak about being a burnout, as I was, right? Grunge before there was grunge. I do not mean to glorify the fact of subcultures that are based on self-destruction, ultimately, right? I have a very odd sense of pride about it, but it's not about the destruction, but rather about having had survived it, right? I am part, and I'll get into this in more detail, but I am part of a group of people who went through what we went through. It came out the other end kind of, sort of okay, you know? And we are compadres in that regard. That's what there is to be proud of, but the lifestyle itself, when you really break it down, lay it on the table, put the light to it, it's shameful. It's an embarrassment. It's not something to be proud of. It is a corruption and a cancer. By no means should it ever be regarded as normal, because the moment it is normal, we're fucked. And we're really teetering towards that point right now. Right? I would say it's commonplace, but it's not yet standard. It's soon to be standard. What's soon to be standard? Freakiness. But anyway, my version of freakiness was to be a burnout. It was grunge before there was grunge. And, I spoke to some of the lead up to the grunge era, which would eventually really become a big part of it in its own right. Not that it was Seattle scene grunge music and lifestyle per se, but during the era, it was prominent music. I mentioned Nine Inch Nails and Jane's Addiction. I mentioned Guns N' Roses and Metallica. They were all part of that grunge era happenstance. I don't know why that word makes me laugh. You know what it makes me think of? And only New York City area people from probably back in that time would know this. Moominshants. That just popped into my mind when I said, when I thought happenstance, Moominshants. That was some kind of weird fucking, boy, talk about freaky, some weird kind of Broadway production that I can't even fucking put into words, but they used to have it on, they used to advertise it on the local TV, because Broadway is local to us in New Jersey, you know, we could grow up. Moominshants, it's some German word. I don't know if it means like getting pissed on or whatever the fuck, you know, some weird German shit. I don't know how to spell it, so I can't really direct it to it, but that, I think that's why there's a little giggle in my mind when I hear that word or say that word, happenstance. It reminds me of Moominshants. How the drugs did this to me, okay? Moving on, all right? I talk about being grunge before there was grunge. And all like these distinctions, all these components that really made up the grunge era, if not grunge music specifically, but the grunge era, early 90s, 90 to 95, right? We'll put it in there and put it in that bucket. And the distinctions were like the fashions that really indicate the times. Flannel shirts, right? And I think a lot of these distinctions are going to fall in the same line. Flannel shirts were not invented in the early 90s. They were not like developed and created by the seamstress heroin addict girlfriend of the bass player from the fucking Melvins or some shit, right? Flannel shirts existed... I don't know. I should probably look up the history before I open my mouth, but they predate me. You know, well, how do I know that? Because we wore flannel all the fucking time. In fact, these styles, right? As far as the way we dressed, right? Flannel shirts and heavy work boots. In the grunge era, I guess it became specifically Doc Martin boots, which I think suck. But we all wore boots in the burnout era of the early 80s. Right, grunge before there was grunge, which is what we wore. We wore flannel over a pocket t-shirt. We wore blue jeans, sometimes shorts in the summer. They'd be cutoffs, right? Tube socks, just, you know, athletic socks with work boots over it. My work boots were specifically, well, I had a couple different pairs through my teen years. Ultimately, I think around the age of 16, I got a pair of Herman Survivors that were tree climber type of boots. They were a little bit different, but they were still heavy work boots. But this ties into the whole thing I'm talking about here, right? I had tree climber work boots. I wore flannel shirts and the grunge moniker, right? The image of the grunge musician was the guy with the fucking work boots and the flannel. Where did that come from? How did work boots and flannel come into vogue in Seattle? Well, Seattle is surrounded by a forestry industry. So these guys in these bands, they had uncles and cousins and brothers and fathers and shit, the neighbors. They worked in the logging industry. They dressed like fucking lumberjacks dressed, and that's how that got into the Seattle scene. That's the way these kids dressed then, which is no different than the way we dressed 10 years earlier. Burnouts dressed like that. You're basically having a pocket tee, a flannel over it, blue jeans, heavy work boots, and usually a black leather jacket on top, like in the winter especially, right? That's how we dressed. And it wasn't a fashion statement when we were burnouts in the 80s. That was just ordinary fucking clothing. But see, in the grunge era, all this burnout stuff came into its prominence. It came into cultural prominence for a real flash in the pan, right? So you had the flannel shirts, the Doc Martin boots, or just boots in general. I think of the grunge era as like, not only were we shining the light on all the burnout stuff, but we were bringing forward elements of burnout stuff that were really kind of stashed in the closet before that. Like new age and occult things, right? Not that new age and occult didn't exist, just like flannels existed earlier, right? New age and occult goes back, all the way back. Back, all the way back. But what happened with the grunge era is everything was put into the light. And it was the first steps towards normalization of these things. Again, you know, to be a burnout, to be on drugs, that was in the closet. You weren't really outspoken about that sort of thing generally. I was, but generally people weren't, you know. Things involving witchcraft and the occult. You were involved with that. If you were Wiccan, you didn't walk around with a sign on your head say, yeah, kiss me, I'm a Wiccan or some shit like that. That was secretive, right? If you were homosexual, right? About homosexuals being in a closet. That was secretive. Everything that you might consider, well, that was considered freaky in those days was kind of kept in the shadows. The grunge era was the time when all that stuff was put to the light. Maybe I get a little deeper into that as we go. But so you had this new age stuff as part of that, you know. Like when I was a kid, I had tarot cards and I had spell books and I read all kinds of off fucking shit, and I had to go through like almost hell and high water to get my hands on a lot of this stuff. You didn't have the internet where you could just order it. You couldn't go to your Barnes and Noble and buy this kind of shit back then, you know. Libraries rarely had any of it. You had to mail order it or go to specialty stores like in the city somewhere, right? But I did it back then. That's part of the burnout culture. New age and occult is part of it all. The godlessness of it all. Really, anything godless goes. You know, as long as you're on drugs doing it. So anyway, so there's that, new age and occult, and then like tattoos started to become a thing. No, it's not that tattoos didn't exist, but in the prior iteration of humanity, tattoos were mostly reserved for like military people, right? You go off to the Marine Corps and you come back with a bulldog on your arm. You go off to the Navy, you come up with a Popeye anchor on your arm. That's generally how tattoos were. And then the exception to that was, inmate tattoos. You were in a prison and you got little fucking handmade India ink little fucking tattoos in your hand and shit, right? Not very artistic. But you had military tattoos and you had jail tattoos. And then the bikers had tattoos, right? The bikers would get tattoos. And then what happened in the 90s is everybody started getting tattoos. And they didn't just get tattoos. They were getting tattoos like all the fuck over them, right? Literally, some people would get a tattoo. Ooh, a spiny lizard running up the wall right there. That may be the mate looking for mine. All right, duly noted. I gotta go try to catch that dude and bring him home. Anyway, and I doubt it. So don't get all in a huff, right? Chances of me catching that thing are like 1,000,000 to 1. They are so fast. Anyhow, getting back onto it. These tattoos. You start having people that were covered from head to toe in tattoos, right? Tattoos became prominent. They weren't just kind of here and there trickled out through certain subcultures of society. They became mainstream, and it really went over the top. And it's remained as such to this day. But specifically now with the tattoos at that age, you had the tribal style of tattoos, which I never really understood. Tribal, like the Native American, maybe Native North American, maybe Native South American. You had that kind of stuff, tribal. Usually they were like kind of like an armband around your bicep or something like that. Tribal. Sometimes they'd be just odd shit. And they really were. They were just designs. They didn't say anything. You know, it's just really like a design feature. And on the other hand, like the girls would get the the tramp stamp, right? The whale tail, the little tattoo at the small at her back. So these became some of the, you know, just the fact of girls getting tattoo in general was not the newest thing in the world, right? There were girls that got tattoos, but it became a mainstream thing with grunge and the grunge fad and fashion, right? Now, all women were getting tattoos. Now all these women who were getting tattoos were starting to be grandmothers and shit, right? The old story I tell, like, you know, she got the butterfly tattoo in 1993 and now it's a fucking pterodactyl, right? But yeah, tattoos at that point in time. So tattoos became mainstream and prevalent during the grunge era. The other grunge era distinctions, heroin addiction and overdose, they kind of go hand in hand, right? Again, heroin wasn't a new drug by any stretch of the imagination, but it came to prominence in the light of fame. Fame is a big word. I'm going to get into this a little bit later, but the grunge era and fame was a really serious matter, and it leads down all potential avenues, I swear. Like I said, later on, we'll dive into that a little bit more, right? But we can actually see, you could take the bands that had heroin addicts in them, more often than not. Lane Staley is probably the best example, right? Alice in Chains, a singer, he's addiction problems. That shit came up in the lyrics. The battles that these people were having with heroin, with drugs in general, heroin specifically, would show up periodically in the lyrics of songs, right? And with that, you know, the battle is, you know, good and evil. You get the that desire just to go up in flame, burn out, right? Go up in flames and just go directly to hell and not care as long as you're high. And on the other hand, you start getting into like recovery topics, right? 12-step recovery stuff. You hear that in Alice in Chains' song if you're really listening and you know what you're listening for. It's in there. But heroin wasn't the only drug of the time. Ecstasy, right? Ecstasy, what we called when I was in high school, DMDA, right? Because again, ecstasy wasn't nothing new to the grunge era. See what I'm saying? Nothing was really new to the grunge era. It was just a time when all this stuff was gathered together basically in one place and the bright light of scrutiny shined on it for all to see. And then it just opened all the doors of the advancement and multiplication of freakism going forward from that point. But ecstasy was DMDA when I was in high school. It was a powder drug that we took, right? We used to like pour it into like a cup of iced tea or something and just slug it down. But later on, it became called ecstasy, and it was in a pill form. We had our college brethren, right? The burnouts that went off to college, they would come back in the summertime, and they'd have all the pill form ecstasy, and we would do that. And that was not like a great a particular favorite of mine. Now, I was getting less and less psychedelic as I got older and older. I really wore it out up on the front end. You know, when I was a freshman in high school, sophomore, I did acid all the fucking time. And then all the other psychedelics along with it, right? And I just really couldn't seem to get enough. But I wasn't really... I got quickly to the point where I wasn't having any good trips, right? But I kept trying. They were not really good times anymore. There was not a whole lot of incentive. And I just got to the point where I'd be hanging out. We'd be smoking weed. And like somebody would come by. Hey, I got some mushrooms. What do you say? Okay, you know, because you didn't say no to drugs, right? In the 80s, they were telling us to say no to drugs, but we never seemed to. All right, that was Nancy Reagan's little public service push from the White House. Anyway, yeah, say no to drugs. Ecstasy, getting back on track here. Ecstasy was not a favorite of mine. I remember one particular night, like, again, I wouldn't say no, but I didn't go looking for it either. And why I didn't like it was because, and I'll tell it in the story, me and a bunch of dudes hanging out, right? Your proverbial sausage party, right? We're hanging out, and we all do an ecstasy. And I start having this sense that comes with ecstasy, naturally. Like, you just, like, kind of fall in love with everything and anything. Right? And somebody actually made a mention of it in the crew. It's just, yeah, yeah. And then I just thought, like, yeah, but there's the whole goodness about love aspect, but then there's the whole weird vulnerability aspect that's coming with this. It's like my defenses are being obliterated here. I am like the girl who had one wine cooler too many and a line of cocaine. You know, you get to that point with ecstasy where all of a sudden anything is possible. And that's what happened. In the 90s, the ecstasy, the rave clubs, those were signs of the times. But what came with all that shit was this... Oh, what's the word for it? This blossoming of, like, bisexuality, trisexuality. Just try anything, right? All of a sudden, that was, like, very commonplace. Well, up to that point, that was kind of rare, you know? Bisexuality was the stuff for porn stars. It was the shit you got paid to do. It was your profession to just have sex, whatever they told you to have sex with, you know? Maybe, like, you know, on those lines, prostitutes. But just, you know, ordinary Joes hanging out at the bar. Not until the grunge era, you know? I'm sure that's a result of ecstasy. Just what that drug did and the way people responded to it. And again, it made something that was abnormal into normal. It took drugs to do it. Bear that in mind, right? The grunge music, right? I mentioned it. Everything is kind of built around... There's a grunge scene that's built around the music itself, ultimately. You know, you get the fads and the fashions, and you get the attitudes and the actions, you know, things that people do. It's a burnout culture centered around drugs, and it always has music with it, right? And the grunge music was kind of distinctive, you know, kind of dark, gloomy, low bottom, taken from like the old Black Sabbath. In fact, in that time, you started getting the onset of like 7-string guitars, you know, with a lower than an E string. You had the 5-string basses, again, another extra lower string. So you're bringing the bottoms down on everything. You're bringing that sense of heaviness and gloominess and muddiness forward, right? So all those senses of like dark, ancient, Black Sabbath type of heavy metal brought in through the instrumentation, you know, And you had like indie labels. Everybody was on these indie labels, no names. Well, a lot of the Seattle scene, it was like the Sub Pop label. A bunch of the guys were on, but there was other ones around. And so their production, while better than anything I could do at home, wasn't all that great, right? And the bands, they had shitty equipment, and you know, they had shitty engineers, and they had what they had was talent, basically. They had talent and like lacked everything else. So it would seem, but I look at it like raw engineering, like punk rock. You get like low quality output, and that actually turns out to be an important distinction in the grunge music, because it was the post grunge that came later. Its distinction was that it was so polished in comparison, right? So anyway, the indie labels. He had these lyrical themes that involve like psychiatric issues, right? Here we go. That spotlight shining down onto the burnout culture. The burnout culture, and I'm going to get into this. It has its basis in issues, right? Like the Korn LP, issues. Psychiatric issues, behavioral issues, domestic issues, right? So you start getting like your songs, instead of being about Becky and Bo going down to the river on a date and making out, going to the malt shop and catching a movie, you've left that fucking 50s rock and roll way behind, and now you've gotten into really what is a folk aspect, right? Folk and punk lyrical elements and themes get into all these kind of problems, right? Rock and roll stops being rock and roll here, and it becomes something else. Because rock and roll fundamentally is about boy meets girl, goes on a date to the malt shop with Richie and Potsy and Fonzie. That was what rock and roll was. It was literally, rock and roll is a descriptor for the sex act and the music that was rock and roll was basically things that were related to dating, to boys and girls getting together and doing what they will. They were all songs geared toward that. As when we got through the 60s, you had the infusion of folk music come in, which starts bringing in politics. It starts bringing in social awareness, right? That came in through that avenue. And then you had the folk rock, which became the basis for the psychedelic era, the hippie movement, the anti-war stuff, all that shit was going on, right? I've talked about these things before, and you know about these things anyway. I'm not making this shit up. We have themes in the grunge era that are far away from your ordinary Arthur Fonzarelli rock and roll, Bill Haley in the Comet days. It's not boy and girl. Now it's about daddy beats my mom and butt rapes me and I'm all fucked up and you know, shit like that, right? Psychiatric issues, domestic issues, issues of every kind, behavioral issues, suicidal ideation. A lot of songs involve that, like that romanticizing of death, and it became a very dark place. And then you started having elements, like kind of sub-elements in and around grunge. I'll probably get into it a little bit more later, like the vampirism, right? You had a vampire movement, which wasn't actually new. It goes back, but it came to the forefront in this time, right? I'll get into that in a minute. Drug abuse, like I mentioned, right? You had the heroin addiction and the overdose. You had the ecstasy stuff. Drugs in general. Like we were burnouts because we were potheads first, and then pot begets all this other stuff, the gateway drug, as they say. There's drug abuse in general. That your life as a burnout, whatever you call yourself, whatever kind of burnout you are, is centered around partying it up, right? It's drugs and alcohol, and if you're going to write 10 songs, at least one of them is going to have some kind of either direct or indirect focus on the drugs you're doing. Again, I keep going back to Black Sabbath. It's like Black Sabbath month in post-Arlen, Texas. Yeah, Sweet Leaf, Snowblind, right? Those guys were singing songs. The whole song was about drugs that they were doing. So, drug abuse, right? As part of a lyrical theme in the grunge era. Nihilism, of course, you know, godlessness, lack of truth. They go hand in hand. They beget one another. So, within the themes, your perspective of expression, nihilistic, not always, but frequently, you know, not by rule or anything, but again, frequently. And like I said before, the injection of like social awareness, raising a gun control issue like the lefties always want to do, right? I've brought it up in prior episodes, the fact that Jeremy by Pearl Jam, right? Grunge era, grunge band, Seattle grunge band. Jeremy was a song about a kid a town over from here in Richardson, Texas, Richardson High School. An ex of mine grew up in Richardson, right? I got baptized in Richardson. Anyway, all beside the point. Biographical shit, right? It was about a kid who went into his high school class and shot himself, right? Jeremy spoke in class today. Kid who never said anything, or he spoke today. It's one of the grunge anthems, actually. But what is it speaking to? Well, it's really speaking to a lot of things. You know? Gun control, like I mentioned, becomes a part of it, but also the why of it. Why is a kid at that age killing himself? Why is he doing it in the school, right? You can kill yourself at home. You can kill yourself in the woods. You can go out in the desert and kill yourself, you know? Why you do it in school? That kid was making a statement. So there's multiple levels, multiple layers of it that you can explore through the lyrics and all. But that's an example of social awareness, lyrical themes that were happening in the grunge era. Now, prior to that, not so much, you know. You might have bands hint at a thing or two. Of course, the punk rockers were doing that shit 10, 12 years earlier, 20 years earlier, you know, 10, 20 years earlier, call it that way. And, of course, the folk rock era and the hippie music was getting into that stuff where it involved, like, the race, where it involved Vietnam, anti-war sentiment, things of that nature, right? So you had that folk rock element of lyrics being brought in, but it went to some really fucking dark places. It wasn't necessarily strictly about social awareness, you know, society as a whole. Now you're looking at shit that's really personal. Everybody's own personal dark demons and what they're doing and how that adds into the whole fucking mess. But so you had that, right? And one other element of lyrical themes that is worth noting, right? I brought it up a little earlier, is the trouble with fame, right? You had these burnouts, basically. They all hung out together in a clique of people that did this burnout stoner music in Seattle. And one day they're just doing their thing, and the next day they have all these major labels coming to sign them on, make them rich and famous. And so many of these guys had a real fucking problem transitioning from ordinary burnout Joe into, you know, superstar on the fucking cover of the magazines with all the money and everything. And a lot of the songs that they sang, because musicians will do it. Musicians will sing about music. Musicians will sing about life on the road, right? I call it, incestuous, right? Incestuous songwriting. You're really just writing music about music, ultimately, right? Well, the grunge version of that was the struggle they had being famous, or as fame was coming to them, and then dealing with everything that came with it. And, you know, we'll speak a little bit more to that, perhaps, but that was some of the lyrical content.
The Down Comes series continues in the next release of Post Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postharlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postharlan.com.